This is 1330 WRCA Watertown, Boston.
Everybody into the Wayback Bus. It's time for Tube Talk on WRCA 1330 AM.
Hiya, fellas. Yeah, man. Here we are again with Swing Time, all set to make your loudspeaker sing out at you with a little sweet and a little hot. And here up comes the first one, and it turns out to be Johnny Mercer's solid smash, Accentuate the Positive. You've got to accentuate the positive, eliminate the negative, latch on to the affirmative, don't mess with Mr. In-Between. You've got to spread joy up to the maximum, bring gloom down to the minimum, have faith and pandemonium liable to walk upon the sea. Affirmative, don't mess with intermittent. To illustrate my last remark, Jonah in the whale, Noah in the lark. What did they do just when everything looked so dark? Man, they said you better let send the in the positive, eliminate the negative, latch on to the affirmative, don't mess with Mr. In Between.
Good evening again, friends, and Welcome to Tube Talk. As you can tell, Uncle Polly, his voice is on the fritz. So you're going to have to bear with me here. But we're back. It's Friday night. It's 10 o'clock. It's WRCA. And we're here for you each and every Friday night. We opened up with Martha Ray doing a classic Johnny Mercer version of Accentuate the Positive. And we had a little Dick Hames with Maybe by George and Ira Gershwin. And you know, folks, with all the discussion floating around about healthcare these days, I thought it would be timely to remind you that Tube Talk is your prescription for the radio blahs. We have the remedy to cure the malaise of modern music and homogenized programming that is so prevalent on the radio today. We are the unique cure. Dosage instructions are as follows. Take 1 hour of Tube Talk Friday nights at 10 p.m. on WRCA each week, and you will be completely cured. If not, please email us at tubetalk1@gmail.com for further instructions. And Eureka, well, you may be cured, but as for me, well, that's a subject of an upcoming miniseries, I guess. You know, I was recently chatting with some radio pals, and a fellow radio enthusiast was bemoaning the fact that many younger folks consider radio to be trailing edge technology. And then, you know, we both came around to agree here that, you know, despite what some people may think, radio technology is the building block of all present day technology, and the radio technology that evolved and spun off so many modern conveniences is the foundation, the cornerstone, the cutting edge that led to what we have today. So, you know, just put that in your pipe and smoke it, because you know, we just wanted to get that off our chests, and we're feeling a little bit better now. Way to play that horn, Harry. That's Harry James. Concerto for Trumpet. And I think he needs to give a little accreditation there to Rossini. I heard a little bit of the Green Hornet in there. I don't know about you. Our nifty guest tonight on Tube Talk is Dan Hsu from the Antique Radio Club of Illinois. Dan is a vacuum tube enthusiast and is also a very active photographer and has been the club photographer out there for a little while. And if we may digress, when did you get into the photography game?
I started doing photography back in high school. It's just sort of one of those things I kind of got interested in and learned how to do darkroom work and did mostly black and white back in those days, back in the early 60s.
Yeah, that's the black and white stuff is nice, and I've seen some folks who will photograph their antique radios in black and white they'll try to put them in period settings with period furnishings and period accoutrements, and it's a neat effect. You know, it really kind of conveys what some of these things probably look like in some of the ads, you know, from way back when. So we are here tonight to discuss vacuum tubes with Dan. So, I mean, that is certainly the name of the show. And as we think from this seat, the keystone, the foundation of modern day civilization. So we're very happy he could join us here tonight. And, you know, what we'd like to talk a little bit, get started here, Dan, is, you know, what about a little history on this? How did tubes differ, say, from, you know, the early days of the 20s when radio was more of a hobby to the 30s when it started to get, you know, very commercially more viable and into the 40s? Were there significant changes or moderate changes? What should we look for?
Well, of course, back in the early days, they were pretty crude. the manufacturers didn't know an awful lot about the tubes. DeForest himself sort of stumbled onto it by accident and went as far as he could with it. And some of your listeners have probably seen photographs of some of the old DeForest Audions, the single wings and double wings. They're a pretty crude instrument.
Sure, yeah, they look like something from a Rube Goldberg convention.
Yeah, of course, then later on when tubes started to become popular and manufacturers had to go into mass production methods, they became a lot more developed automatic machinery to manufacture them. Back in the early 30s and on through the 30s, vast new numbers of types were coming out. The early days, the 01As, everybody made 01As, and they were all pretty much the same, and that's about all you could get with the battery sets. But then when the AC tubes started to become popular, they started about 1927. For general use, there were some earlier experimental ones. But in 27, RCA came out with the Type 26 and the Type 27, and the AC-powered sets started to get popular. And, of course, with mass production methods, things got quite a bit more refined. Later, they went to the metal types. RCA put an awful lot of work into research and development of the metal types, and they had a terrible time initially getting those things to even work. I think their goods were only about 10% of their production at first, but they developed that later on. Of course, in the 40s, during wartime, there was a really big push on development of much better tubes, smaller tubes, higher frequencies, on up through the beginning of the miniatures for portable radios, which were much smaller, of course, and they were a lot more complicated to manufacture.
Sure.
Yeah, go ahead, please.
Just the scale. And, you know, and maybe you can speak to this. I mean, it may just be, you know, from a manual. I don't know if there's a technical standpoint behind why things were like they were. But, you know, it seems as if in the 20s we went from tubes that had four-pin bases. Some of them were much larger in size than what we started to expect. You know, when we see tubes in the 30s, some of them may have been, you know, they have different colors. You know, I hear people talk about, correct me if I'm wrong, but Arcturus blue tubes. Mm-hmm. And was this marketing? Was it for effect? Was there, you know, scientific reasoning behind the way some of these things were? Or was it just a function of the type of tube that was available at the time and what the manufacturer had to do to actually just make the thing?
Well, some of them, like the blue tubes, were pretty much more decorative than functional. The glass, the type of glass, doesn't really matter much as long as it'll hold a vacuum. So it was more marketing than anything else. That, and also the tube cartons had some rather elaborate artwork on them, And that was more of a marketing thing, too, because pretty much in those days, everybody made tubes. A lot of people made tubes, and they had to have some sort of a gimmick or an ad.
Sure.
To sell them.
Some way to try to stand out. And there are people who are so enamored of that artwork, you know, especially some of those larger boxes. That's all they collect is boxes.
George Fathauer has quite a large collection of tube boxes, and they're really impressive. Some of the artwork is just really stunning.
Yeah, I found a fellow online, and I can't remember the URL right now, but he's primarily interested in tubes from audio point of view, audio amp musician, but he has an extensive collection of boxes and has them all scanned and on his website, and he delights in even pointing out typographical errors and all kinds of interesting things. It's just a whole subset of the hobby. So, you know, when we talked about the metal tubes a little bit, when you were talking about RCA, I mean, they really made that, I know, because I've seen some of the ads, all metal tubes. Now, I know that those were done to assist in, mitigating the need for a shield in some cases. Was there any other value to having a tube enveloped in metal other than, again, it was one of these greatest new things, you know, that you had to have?
Well, it had more than marketing appeal. Of course, they really pushed that for marketing appeal, too. It was something different. They were more rugged. Of course, you can't break a metal tube like
sure.
you can a glass one. The other major improvement was the fact that you didn't have the big press inside the tube and the long leads that led from the actual tube elements down into the base and down to the base pins. You could shorten that up. They had a metal disc on the bottom that each of the wires went through independently of the other, and they had a lot less inductance and capacitance to the wires, so they were better at high frequencies.
You know, that's interesting, and you know, they stuck with those. I know there are a lot of sets that they later, you know, manufactured that were sort of a mix. You'd have the old GTs, and then you'd have some of the metal tubes in there. And mm-hmm. to my chagrin, you know, especially in my earlier experience in the hobby, sometimes I would replace a similar type with a GT instead of the metal tube, and I got less than satisfactory results, in some case horrible results. And some old-timers said, hey, you know, you have to substitute with the correct thing, you know, find out what it was, and then it started to make a little bit more sense. And, you know, one of the other things we had discussed prior to coming on was, and a lot of people are hung up on manufacturers, and I guess that's a very American thing, you know, Madison Avenue and all, but yeah, you know, I guess in the world of tubes, there really were, you know, there were many companies that made them, just like there were many radio companies, but, you know, there were few primary manufacturers. So, you know, the Raytheons, the Kenrads, the GEs and RCAs, you know, to name some of the real big ones, Tungsol, I guess you could put in there, you know, were making these tubes for companies that were smaller companies or more concerned with just producing radios, companies like Emerson and Admiral and Silvertone, who was, you know, House, Ward's Airline. They were all made by just a few companies. Was the manufacture of these devices such that it required the resources of a big company, and that's why the manufacturer sort of centered around some of these bigger companies, and a lot of the smaller radio manufacturers, just that was just an area they didn't have the money to get into or the technical skill to get into?
Well, yeah, it's a real big deal to develop and manufacture a vacuum tube. It requires some very specialized equipment and some highly experienced and trained people. It's there's a lot of art to it than science. I remember just recently when RCA decided to get out of certain tube business at Fermilab, we used some of the very large many megawatt vacuum tubes that RCA had made years ago. And now the people that are making them had to call back some of the old RCA employees because they just couldn't do it the same way. And it was the same with the small radio manufacturers. It would have been far too expensive for them to develop and to manufacture their own tubes when they could buy them for less than a dollar a piece from one of the big guys and put them in the radios. And because everything in the radio business in those days and even now was driven by the dollar.
Sure, driven by cost. And, what, you know, to your point, what, you know, why make it if we can get it reasonably priced enough? And, you know, we, without that overhead, we'll just shave another couple of dollars off the, you know, the Emerson set here, the old Emerson 509. We'll market that. It'll be $5 less than the RCA set. And, you know, I know RCA certainly made a lot of money selling replacement tubes as well as equipment. But I guess, you know, just in the like today, for the premium names, you did pay a little bit more of a premium price back then. So from a collector's point of view, if you're interested in restoring your set, you really shouldn't worry then. You know, what you replace a tube with is chances are, even if it's a generic brand of the day, a Wizard or a Silvertone, it was made by a significant manufacturer and should perform, you know, up to snuff, I would say, huh?
Well, of course, in the early days, the 01A days, there were, hundreds of manufacturers of tubes, and some of them were good and some of them were bad. Once you get past the 20s into the 30s, probably pretty much anything you want to put in the socket is going to work pretty well.
So it shouldn't be too hung up on the manufacturer.
No, I wouldn't worry about it.
Now, were some companies more... I guess to try to put this in a, because there were so many different types of tubes, this is going to be a difficult question for me to form here. But were some companies better at certain types of tubes, or again, as long as, you know, they were meeting the standards that they had set for, you know, the performance and the behavior of that tube, does it really matter? Did Tungsol make better audio output tubes? I know there are some people who talk about 6550s and just go absolutely mad over them, and that was Tungsol's thing. And were companies better or worse at certain things, or as long as they were making them to, you know, significantly, you know, a quality spec, what's the big deal with something like that? Does it even matter?
Well, it's interesting that you brought up the 6550, because Tungsol developed and marketed the 6550. They made the 6550 for other manufacturers. You'll see them with RCA or Sylvania numbers, or identification on them.
But sure.
I think Tungsol made pretty much all of them. There may have been some later on, some Chinese companies make them. But if you go to something like a 6L6, where everybody made them,
yep.
Of course, with audio, some people can hear something. They like this one better. They like that one better. But as far as specifications, they pretty much all had to meet the registration. All the tube types are registered with the EIA.
Mm-hmm.
And they had certain specifications they had to meet, and they met them. They weren't really worried too much back in those days about tweaking the audio, as long as they worked and
sure.
They were supposed to work as well as they were designed to. You get into modern-day tubes, then you're going to start seeing the tweaks, and the different manufacturers are going to have little different characteristics. But other than that, they're all going to be about the same.
Now, for the newbies in the audience, EIA is Electrical Industry. What is EIA the acronym for?
The Electronics Industry Association.
Very good. Very good. So, now, you know, one of the questions that comes up, and it seems, you know, certainly every swap meet I go to, there's always a few guys or gals who, you know, plenty of tubes, you know, there's tables full of them in boxes and all, you know, bins. Some of them are pulled. Some of them are, you know, new in box or in white boxes. There seems to be an awful lot of them still around, and certainly you see them all over the internet. But are certain ones legitimately getting harder to find, or is, you know, scarcity the function of people who want to make money, you know, selling certain ones that they have?
Well, naturally, it's a little bit of both. The ones you generally see at swap meets are the 60s, 70s TV set tubes, and they're pretty much worthless because those TVs are gone, and even if they weren't, nobody'd want to really fix them up. They just don't have any popularity. The tubes that are getting scarce, or the ones you're going to have a hard time finding, are the popular audio tubes, like the 12AU7s, 12AX7s, 6FN7s, 6SL7s, things that you're going to find in a typical guitar amp.
Yep.
Or some high-end audio stuff. Those are the ones that you're going to have hard time finding, and the prices are, they're going up substantially. And then within those categories, you're going to have more expensive and more scarce types of different manufacturers. For example, the Telefunkens. That's kind of the golden fleece of audio tubes, followed by maybe Amperex and a few other companies. It's interesting, though. Some tubes that I have tested, and I've done noise testing on a lot of tubes, like audio tubes, 12AX7s, 12AU7s, and the like. And some of the later tubes made in the 80s by the Japanese actually were quite good. They have very low noise, very low microphonics. Some of them are equal to the Telefunken in that respect. However, a lot of the audio people don't really like them. They don't think they sound that good, but they certainly do have the characteristics that you would want in a good tube as far as low noise and low microphonics. Some of the big names like RCA, Sylvania, GE, it's interesting because you can test one and it's absolutely quiet. Test another one, same lot number, everything, and it's noisy. So you do have to be a little bit careful, and you kind of have to pick and choose what you're using.
You know, the whole thing about vacuum tubes that I find fascinating, too, is it's, you know, when you look at, as we were discussing earlier, the in scientific research, the engineering, the manufacturing of the equipment, you know, to make them, you know, this whole industry behind them. So if you get a chance sometime, you know, if you're lucky enough to have somebody in your club who has some good books, or I know there's a interesting website, and I think they cater mostly to people who are into audio. It's called Vintage Tube Services. I believe it's a fellow up in Michigan, and he has some very interesting photographs behind the scenes, you know, in different factories. He has some photos of, I don't know if it was Sylvania or RCA, but literally, you know, looks like piles of tubes that were seconds, and they would destroy them at the factory because they did not want them to go out, you know, in any manner, way, shape, or form, or to leak out of the company, so to speak, and be sold off by jobbers, you know, or somebody who was, you know, a small seller who wasn't too concerned, just really, you know, was interested in the cost. But you look at some of the vast production lines and then the testing arrays, and there's a great photo on one of the old electronics magazines, and I've seen it around from time to time. It pops up on people's website, and it's on the Vintage Tube Services site. There's this woman in a rather striking red dress, and she's at the tongue saw plant, and she's testing. And she has her clipboard, and she's plugging these things in. So, I mean, it does look like there was a certain degree of quality assurance that went on, maybe far beyond what we'd expect in modern-day electronics that all went on behind the scenes with these things. So, I mean, I guess it is interesting if some, as you were saying, from the same lot would behave differently than another. Do you think that was just manufacturing, or maybe the way they were stored or treated, or what do you think would account for that?
Probably a little bit of everything.
Yeah.
Naturally, when you're making a mechanical device like that, you're going to have variations in every single one that you make. Microphonics, of course, are a function of how well the internal elements are stabilized and held in place by the mica wafers and the stem design and things like that. So certain tubes that are designed for low microphonics take all of that into account, and they're generally much quieter. As far as other noises, it's interesting because you can't tell by looking at them. One of them looks just the same as the other, and you put it into a noise test, and one of them is really loud and almost unusable, and other ones aren't. It's kind of a guess as to what they're going to do.
Sure, sure. Now, you know, this is kind of things come into my head during interviews, and invariably, whether anyone else, even sometimes my guests find them remotely relevant or interesting. Well, you know, this is just what goes on in my head. Now, you know, I have seen, you know, you get a radio and you check it out, you bring it up on the Variac, you want it, you know, what's the capacitors look like, blah, blah, blah. And then, you know, you check out the tube. So the first thing you might do is if you have a tester, you might test them, or you might, as you're bringing up the set, see which ones obviously are starting to, you know, to bring the glow up. Anyway, so you check a tube, and you're twisting the glass top of the tube, and gee, it seems loose in that base, and it turns back and forth a little bit. Now, not significantly, not to the point where you can turn it around like the top of a bottle and screw it out. Is a condition like that something that you say, hey, you know, I'd probably be better off replacing this, or if that movement isn't too pronounced, is that something you can live with and the tube should perform up to snuff?
Yeah, it won't bother the performance at all, although if you twist it enough, you may break one or more of the wires
the right, that go to the pins, right, okay.
I have heard that marine varnish is really good as an adhesive, so you put a little marine varnish in there, and it seeps down into the tube base, and it'll stabilize it. What I have done with them, if they're bad enough, is I'll go ahead and remove the base, unsolder the wires, and remove the base, and use either super glue or maybe a good urethane glue.
Sure.
Stick it back on again, let it cure, you're fine.
Yeah, it's funny the things that you find. I had a 35Z5 tube in an RCA 6 tube set, And it had, I was having a little reception issue with the set, so I, you know, I, as the chassis was out of the cabinet and I was looking at it, it appeared as if at the very top of the tube, I guess what you would call a cathode, it almost looked like a cigarette butt ash. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering, what is that, a common thing, an uncommon thing? And I had never seen it. I asked a few other people. They said, you know what, just swap it out for what it's worth. But I mean, sometimes do you notice that there are these unique phenomenon you see when you're testing things?
Well, in the case of the 35Z5 or maybe something like a 50L6 where it's got a pretty good high-power filament in it, the filament, of course, is coated with a material to insulate it from each other, the strands of the filament, and also from the cathode. And that's a sort of, it's not exactly a ceramic material, but it's like a ceramic material. And during manufacturing, it can take on almost any kind of an appearance. But as long as you don't have any heater to cathode shorts, it's probably not going to make any difference at all.
Now, why do you find in some tubes that the inside of the tube appears to be coated with, and I don't know what the material is, so I'll say what it looks like, a gray paint? Mm-hmm. And so was that by design again, or does that serve some type of a performance function inside the tube?
Well, I've never got an entirely satisfying answer on that. I know what you mean. Some of the tubes, especially I've seen some 50L6s with like a black paint inside.
Yes.
Some of them I've seen like a gray material inside, and as they put the tube up into the envelope, you can see where the micas have scratched some of the gray off.
Right, exactly, yes. So why are these little lines that run up the thing? Yes.
The best answer I can give you is that it's a conductive material, and it collects up charge off of the inside of the glass envelope and directs it to an area that prevents the tube from being affected by collected charge inside the glass.
That's interesting.
The electron stream comes out and does strike the glass, and the electrons have to go someplace, and they build up a charge on the inside of the glass.
That's interesting.
Now, somebody may want to dispute that, but I would be welcome to anybody who actually knows the manufacturer's
best answer I've heard. And then, so, you know, then the next lead into that is why on some tubes, and I seem to notice this particularly with Sylvania, but that's, you know, probably nothing more than a coincidence, there's a silvery coating usually on the top of the tube itself, but you know the sides are clear glass and you can see through the sides, but there's a silver coating on the inside. And again, is that a similar type function, do you think, to absorb stray energy?
That is actually called gettering. Mm-hmm. And it's a material that's flashed under the inside of the tube during pump down. And it's a metallic. There are several different types of metallics that are used. And it actually will grab and sequester remaining air molecules that are in the tube after manufacture. Because after manufacture, during manufacture, they put them on what's called a Selex machine, which pumps them down, heats them up to red heat using induction heat to drive the air molecules out of the internal elements. They flash the getter, and then they seal the thing off, and it's closed off the atmosphere for the rest of its life.
Sure.
Well, any material that's been in air is going to continue to outgas over time, and tubes are no different. They're going to have some residual gas inside that's going to evolve out of the surfaces of the metallic elements. So what the gettering is for is it traps those air molecules, grabs them and sequesters them and holds them onto the surface to maintain the vacuum inside the tube.
Very interesting. And, you know, we're just going to press the pause button here for a little bit. This is Tube Talk. I am Paul Burish. Our guest this evening is Dan Hsu. And what else are we talking about? We are talking about vacuum tubes here on WRCA. So, you know, what I guess it all kind of comes down to here is, something that you enjoy most, which is physically testing and watching tubes' characteristics. You know, we should be less concerned about brand and, you know, maybe how dinged up the thing looks. It comes down to voltage gain, transconductance, and plate resistance are really the three characteristics that you know, are going to make or break something as far as is it going to work in your radio. And how do you test for some of these things? Maybe you could just give us a quick overview on that and tie that in with what we were talking about earlier.
Well, of course, the fast and easy way is to just use a commercial-grade tube tester. And that's fine for most service work. If you just want to find out if the tube is functional or not, if it's weak,
sure.
if it's gassy, if it's got shorts. If you really want to get into the nitty-gritty of tube characteristics, say, for example, you've got an audio amp and you want to match the output tubes in it. If you put it on a tube tester, it's not going to tell you much. It'll tell you one-point reading, which is not going to tell you if they're matched or not. A tube tester can tell you if a tube is not matched, if two tubes read differently. But if they read the same, you're only looking at one point in the operating curves, and that is over the entire plate voltage range, plate current range, and grid bias range. The best way to match a tube is what's called a curve tracer. And a curve tracer is an instrument that's used to plot the characteristics of a device, like a transistor or a tube, in a graphical form, and it shows you the plate voltage from zero to whatever the maximum rating is on the tube, let's say 350 volts, and the plate current from zero to whatever the maximum plate rating is, say 100 milliamps, all in one graphical display.
Sure.
So that way you can plot one tube and compare it against another, and it'll show you over the whole operating range, all the plate voltages, plate currents, and grid biases all at once, and you can tell immediately if any of the curves diverge from each other. So that's a really good way to match tubes is with a curve tracer.
So it does not mean did they both come in a blue box from the same company?
No. I have actually seen two different manufacturers. I did some experiments with 6V6s, and I dropped an RCA on one side, and I dropped a GE on the other side, and physically they look quite different. But they could still have identical characteristics, although I don't think anybody who's really seriously into audio would accept and use an RCA and a GE in the output stage. But as far as the tubes are concerned, you couldn't tell the difference.
Now, you know, as I was mentioning a little bit before we started our chat, I was poking around, you know, looking at some material here before we were going to talk tonight. And over on Sonny Clutter's site on the Radiola Guy, he had an interesting little article here, and he tries to keep it simple, you know, because I'm sure he gets so many hits from a lot of people who are experienced in radio and some people who are you know, just casually looking at things. And, you know, one of the things he addresses here and you know, bring up the topic of eBay, which I know always gets people foamed up for one reason or another in the radio hobby. You know, you'll see people who are advertising a tube, and they say it displays a near NOS reading. And, you know, so what is that supposed to mean? And, you know, he's basically of the opinion, well, it might not mean that they're dishonest. Maybe they just don't know much about vacuum tubes, and that, you know, a tube is really going to test based to its specifications. And whether it's new, old stock in a box, if you had something that was taken out of the box and put in a set, but the set was never really used very much, they're both strong tubes and they were made well, there's no difference, and you shouldn't charge somebody, you know, conceivably charge somebody more for one or the other. So other than the fact that you'd want to check for shorts and internal element leakage, is there anything else you'd want to look at? I mean, certainly for somebody who says, oh, gee, these test like new, well, that's not really a very valid criteria, is it?
No, it isn't, because what is it that they tested it with? Did they test it with an emission tester? Did they test it with a transconductance tester? You really don't know much about what the tube is actually doing. You don't know how much life has left in it. You don't know if it sags on the high end. This is typical of audio tubes. If they've been in use for a while, they may have a perfectly good transconductance, but if you try and push them, they haven't got the plate current to keep it up. And again, this is where if you put one in a curve tracer, it will tell you that immediately.
I see. And, it, you know, to get back to where we started long ago when we first had you on the show, you were talking about, and Sonny mentions it here, you know, standards were set up long ago as to what the minimum acceptable readings, or in some models, the average of a tube should be. And, you know, so you could have a nicely playing 5 or 6 tube set, or even a bigger set than that. And, you know, you may have a tube in there that you could put on a tester, and the tester might tell you it's weak, quote unquote, but the set may be playing fine with plenty of volume, and, you know, you really shouldn't worry about it until the thing stops playing, right?
Yeah, since tubes are no longer manufactured, at least the common types, the All-American 5 cable radio tubes, it really is incumbent on us to sort of conserve them rather than just, well, this one's weak, I'll throw it in the trash.
Right, right.
Okay, yeah, it's a cheap tube. You can go out and get another one probably for $1 to swap meet. But there are only so many of them left. And if the tube is performing in the circuit and doing an adequate job, leave it there. It all depends on the design of the radio, how much tolerance it has for a tube that's a little bit on the soggy side. And if it still works, don't bother with it. Keep it in there and let her go.
Yeah, I recently had a little set here. And again, I think I mentioned it earlier, Emerson 509. Little five-tube set, but it has a five-inch speaker, and it's kind of cute to look at. But, you know, even after a recapping, and I thought we had got the tubes, you know, checked well, it was needed a little bit of work. Some of the tube sockets were a little oxidized, which was compromising its performance, and so we got that squared away. But we did find, and I couldn't tell you exactly which ones were in there, but, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if one was the output tube. You know, it was weaker than it should have been, you know, and I mean, it was probably acceptable. I was having trouble getting more than one or two stations, and I, from what people had told me, oh, no, these are, even though it's a simple set, it should be a little bit better than that. So I had a pal of mine in the club here look at it, and he said, no, he said, let's just try, we'll take these two weak ones. And in this particular case, with this particular radio, the, you know, gain was obvious. I mean, I went from something that was picking up three or four of the big, you know, local powerhouse stations, and I started to pick up everything across the band, and I noticed the sound seemed a little bit better as well. It was a little bit more distinct. So in that case, you know, it wasn't the, you know, the situation where I could get by with something that was a little bit weak. But so I guess the advice would be is it can vary based on your radio. It can vary based on the tube. And, you know, if it's something that still sounds pretty good, even though the tube test's weak, to your point, why spend the money? And we should probably hang on to the tube.
Yeah, substitution really was the old-time radio shop repair method. They would test them occasionally, but generally they'd put another tube in. If the radio worked better, okay, it went out the door with a new one.
And we put it on the invoice accordingly, I'm sure.
Uh-huh.
So,
yep.
In any event, you know, Dan, it's an education to sit here and to listen to what makes it all possible, which is the vacuum tube. I mean, we wouldn't have tubular sound without them. And to find out a little bit more as to why even some of my off-the-wall questions may, you know, to get answers to them is a good thing. And it's enlightening, and it's always great having you on. So I appreciate it. And maybe we can go down the tube road again and talk a little bit about the building block that makes it all possible, so to speak. So thanks so much for being on. I appreciate it. And I wish you a great night.
Well, thank you, Paul. It's an honor to be a guest on your show.
Take care now. Bye-bye.
Out in the west Texas town of El Paso, I fell in love with a Mexican girl. Nighttime would find me in Rose's Cantina. Music would play and Felina would whirl. Blacker than night were the eyes of Felina, wicked and evil while casting a spell. My love was deep for this Mexican maiden. I was in love, but in vain I could tell. One night a wild young cowboy came in, wild as the West Texas wind. Dashing and daring, a drink he was sharing with wicked Felina, the girl that I love. So in anger I challenged his right for the love of this maiden. Down went his hand for the gun that he wore. My challenge was answered in less than a heartbeat. The handsome young stranger lay dead on the floor. Out through the back door of Roses I ran, out where the horses were tied. I caught a good one, it looked like it could run. Up on its back and away I did ride, just as fast as I could, from the West Texas town of El Paso back to the badlands of New Mexico. Back in El Paso, my life would be worthless. Everything's gone in life, nothing is left. It's been so long since I've seen the young maiden. My love is stronger than my fear of death. I saddled up and away I did go, riding alone in the dark. Maybe tomorrow a bullet may find me. Tonight nothing's worse than this pain in my heart. And at last here I am on the hill overlooking El Paso. I can see Rose's cantina below. My love is strong and it pushes me onward. Down off the hill to Felina I go. Off to my right I see five mounted cowboys. Off to my left, right, a dozen or more. Shouting and shooting, I can't let them catch me. I have to make it to Rose's back door. Something is dreadfully wrong, for I feel a deep burning pain in my side. Though I am trying to stay in the saddle, I'm getting weary, unable to ride. But my love for Felina is strong, and I rise where I've fallen. Though I am weary, I can't stop to rest. I see the white puff of smoke from the rifle. I feel the bullet go deep in my chest. From out of nowhere, Felina has found me, kissing my cheek as she kneels by my side. Cradled by two loving arms that I'll die for, one little kiss and Felina goodbye.
Thank you, Mighty Robbins. That's certainly an old standby. Nice Western song tells a story. I like things that tell stories. I try to tell a few stories. Thanks to our guest, Dan Hsu, for joining us from the Antique Radio Club of Illinois. You know, Dan has written extensively on vacuum tubes. And if you have old copies or older copies of Antique Radio Classified, you can find many of his interesting articles. It is enlightening and informative. This is Tube Talk, your connection to the world of radio past. We do this every Friday at 10 p.m. This program is brought to you by me, Paul Burish, and our indefatigable webmaster, Chicago Jimmy. This broadcast comes to you from Boston, Massachusetts, hub of the universe. Well, you know, we like to think so. Our studios here overlook the Back Bay, which, as you may have heard, was the scene of great tragedy, as we've recently lost two Boston firefighters in a hideous blaze fanned by some unbelievable winds right off the water. And I felt I should say something about this, but it is hard to put the feelings that are flowing through all the different neighborhoods in the city into words. So all I can say is God bless Fireman Walsh and Kennedy and their families. You know, firefighting, I guess, is much like war. As you know, fire is an active thing. It's an active enemy, and there's other parallels to war involved. And then it can be very costly to fight, and sadly some fight and pay with their lives. So let's give our deepest thanks to all who fight the fires, fight the bad guys, and fight for our nation. To all of our courageous men and women in the services, and all our first responders, thank you.
Once in a lullaby, somewhere over the rainbow, skies are blue, and the dreams that you dare to dream really do come true. Someday I'll wish upon a star and wake up where the clouds are far behind me. Where troubles melt like lemon drops away above the chimney tops, that's where.
We'd like to thank you, our listening audience, for tuning in. Check out the Tube Talk website at tubetalkclassicradio.org. As people often ask of the antique radio enthusiast, and, you know, we've talked about this and danced around this for a long time here on the show, but, you know, it's something that constantly comes up. Why do you want to listen to a 70-year-old radio? You know, some people think you might want to collect them because they're cute to look at, or the dials are fun, and oh gee, that's a nice cabinet. Why do you want to listen? Well, as I sat listening to a cute little Emerson 509 that we've previously mentioned on the program this evening, that with the help of a crack technician and fellow member of the New England Antique Radio Club, I pondered this thought. You know, and it's a funny thing, I guess, you know, you get to experience what the early listener got to experience, though. You know, there was certainly less stray RF in those days. If the vintage listener had a fairly advanced set and conditions were good, they had a real first-class experience. If they had a little midget set, they still may have had good sound on some of the strong locals. In either case, if the gods of the ether were not in a cooperative mood, they may sit and listen to their favorite music or program and have to put up with a little static or a little crackling or a little hiss. But they still enjoyed it. And really, when that radio was all you had, that was a good thing. It was a good thing. And the experience is still much the same. Some radios performing better, some okay, and outside interference of one sort or another can certainly still cause some havoc. That is why I listen, not only for the programs or the music, but to share that vintage experience. And you too can get that same feeling with your own well-restored vacuum tube set. As you sit by the glowing dial, the Art Deco numerals aglow, in the darkness of your own parlor, to commune with those radio fans that have gone before us, ah yes, that, my friends, is what it's all about. You know, part of listening to this show is putting up with Uncle Paul's likes, and I like this guy, and we haven't heard him in a little bit, so music, please.
Wider than a mile, I'm crossing you in style someday. Oh, dream maker, you heartbreaker, wherever you're going, I'm going your way to. The world, there's such a lot of world to see. after the same rainbow's end, waiting round the bend, my huckleberry friend. Wherever you're going, I'm going your way. Two drifters off to see the world. There's such a lot of world to see. We're after that same. My huckleberry friend, Moon River, and me.
Thank you very much, Andy. What a voice. Certainly better than my voice is tonight, I'll tell you that. Maybe next week I'll play the Justin Bieber version of Moon River. Don't worry, friends. There isn't one, and there will never be one, because you've got to have a voice to sing that song. We are the keepers of the glowing vacuum tube. We are here each and every week. Every radio preservationist must play his part. I suggest you do that by restoring your sets. Keep buying those tubes. Keep listening to Tube Talk. How's that for a little vested interest? It's almost time for us to meander over the Moon River for this evening here. So again, thanks, gangs, for listening. We'll see you next week right here on Tube Talk.